Welcome to the 87th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. It's very interesting that this is the 87th episode of my podcast, because in 1987, it's when I graduated from medical school. And I did take the Hippocratic Oath, and I did promise to do no harm. And tonight's episode is me talking about doctor bashing versus doctor responsibility. I have been listening to a number of podcasts over the years on plant-based nutrition, whether it's from nutritionists or registered dietitians or health educators or lay personnels, lawyers, PhDs, or personal trainers. All of them have some valid points. We have been blamed by the lay population for hurting them and not diagnosing them early enough with their diseases. We have been blamed for not being preventative and preventing disease before it happens. We've also been blamed for not understanding nutrition, and the excuse has always been, we're not taught nutrition. Wrong or right, we as physicians have got ourselves into some big problems. We've been backed into the corner financially, legally, and ethically, and it's time that we do something about it. If you look up what it means to be a doctor or a healer, it means basically someone that teaches, educates, and also heals. I recently saw a post by a grade school or high school teacher that said that a grade school teacher makes more decisions in one day than a brain surgeon. Then I guess I would ask, why don't teachers become brain surgeons? Why don't PhDs become MDs? And why don't bloggers and personal trainers become MDs? If it were so easy and they could do it so much better. The reason really is simple. It takes too long, it's too difficult, and you lose a lot of your own life, and you become responsible for everyone else's life and everyone else's health. And nobody really wants to do that at the end of the day. Most of us become physicians because we have a love of science and want to help people. We're not shown shiny cars or big houses when we're an undergrad to say this is what you can get if you become a doctor. We're usually geeky enough to not mind sitting in the chair for hours upon hours through undergrad education and medical school and stay up endless nights in residency. I often tell the story that when I was told as a second year medical student that as a third year medical student I'd have to stay up all night during my clinical rotations, I didn't believe them. I thought there's no way in the world that anybody could be made to stay up all night, especially since I was somebody that liked to take an afternoon nap and go to bed by 10 and get up by 6 or 7. But it was true. When you become a third year medical student, you start to lose sleep, and that continues endlessly throughout the next how many years, usually forever to some degree. There have been changes in residency programs because residents function doing things when they're in a half sleep mode. But I will tell you that being made to tolerate loss of sleep or lack of sleep and be able to make a decision with lack of sleep is a worthwhile endeavor. And I don't agree with how the residency programs have been changed to make it easier on residents, because I think that you need to undergo that to be able to function like we have to function once you're out in the real world. That being said, we all signed up for this, and this is what we have, and this is what we actually enjoy doing despite it all. And I will tell you that most physicians are as comfortable being inside a hospital as they are being inside their own home because of the time that they've spent in there during their training. So it's really not because of lack of effort for our failures. It's more of not being able to see the forest for the trees and just keep plowing through the problems and issues while the world kind of fell down around us. But that's not an excuse, and we need to be the leaders, and we need to stand up and make a change. We fought to get into medical school, and we fought to have the right to wear the white coat and be called doctor. And I will tell you that we all feel that we earned it and that we all like to be called doctor. But with that comes a tremendous responsibility. We've signed up to be leaders and not followers and not people that delegate the responsibility. I don't think patients should be viewed as potential sources of income. unfortunately, in some circumstances, that is what some physicians have felt that they need to do in order to keep their heads above water financially in running their practice. I don't think that physicians should have to be in the realm of being a business person to the fact that they have to worry about keeping their doors open and looking for ways to make money to be able to pay their malpractice and their business overhead and their electronic medical record overhead and their machines overhead. I think that leads to a skewing of their vision as to what we were really meant to do. I'm not going to go in on how physicians should be reimbursed or what they should be in reimbursed for or what type of practice should be in the in the United States with regards to insurance and government-run programs. But what I would like to address is what I believe physicians should do in order to do the right thing and to practice medicine and take back the responsibility of health care. We need to educate patients on what it is to have a disease that you don't really need to have. High blood pressure, certainly we need to diagnose it. Coronary artery disease, strokes, diabetes, and cancers. We need to be able to make accurate diagnosis. But more importantly, we should start to focus on how to prevent those disease or reverse those disease in people that already have them. Spending 10 minutes with a patient is not time enough to even take a history on what's wrong with the patient. Now people are giving these enormous forms to check boxes that's entered by an assistant, and the doctor comes in and looks at the questions and answers a couple of them and sends them out with a prescription. We need to take a history that involves what the patient eats, what's the patient, how the patient exercises, what they do for a living, how their sleep is, what are they exposed to, and what are their goals and problems, and what do they see that their problems are. We need to find out when they started to get sick, not just that they're sick. At what point did you get high blood pressure? What was going on in your life at that time? Was there some sort of emotional trauma that led to ignoring your health? If these things aren't addressed, then you can never get to the bottom or begin to treat a patient. Then there comes the education part. They need to understand what they're eating or what they're not doing and why it's leading to problems with their health. Why? What shouldn't they inhale? And what is a disease mechanism? Why are these things so bad? And why is the alternative, such as eating green leafy vegetables, so good? Gone are the days when patients came in and said, you know, the doctor says you should do this, and they do that. It doesn't happen. And it's not even fathomable to think that by giving people a piece of paper that says go eat a plant-based diet, that they're going to be, one, want to do it or even know how to go do it. The way it's set up in this country, a patient can only see a registered dietitian quarterly. And even the registered dietitians, a lot of them are not, they're educated in the same system where they don't know about the benefits of a whole food plant-based diet. But you can't blame them for not helping a patient if they can only see them once a quarter. They're not magic workers either, so they're not going to be able to get them to change substantially either. So people become very, very much confused. And then when they start to hear on TV that they can take a pill or they can have a procedure done and make it all go away, well, why wouldn't they? Every day in my office, I see patients that the first thing that they say is, I eat pretty healthy. I eat a lot of salad. Now I am 99% vegan, but yet I look at these people and they're still substantially overweight. And they're very unhealthy, and they taking multiple medications, and they have multiple disease boxes checked. Sometimes people are so good at telling me all the good things that they do, yet they look so, and they are so unhealthy, I start to scratch my own head. It's like, you know, well, could this be so? I don't believe they're necessarily lying to me, but I also believe that they haven't seen the truth or been faced with the truth so long that they don't know what it is. I even had a doctor say to me today that they were 30%, I'm sorry, that they went 30 days vegan so far in the first sentence of our conversation, followed by, I'm Cuban and I can't give up my pork, and didn't even realize what they said. So it's obvious that that physician did not understand the problem with eating pork. And they also didn't understand their inability to see what they said and realize probably half of what they're actually eating. Last night was the first hour session of my 6-session nutrition course. We started a new semester, and I've actually changed them so that I'm going every week for an hour. And actually, it was an hour and a half last night. And I spoke for an hour and a half mainly on the science of eating a whole food plant-based diet and how it actually works to reverse hypertension and cardiovascular disease. That's our first talk. And I introduced just what it is to be plant-based. And we talk a little bit about macronutrients such as carbohydrates, protein, and fat. And I try to get the big bugaboo out of the way as far as you're not going to be protein deficient, and carbohydrates can be good. And low fat doesn't mean eating snack well and low fat crackers. So after an hour and a half of speaking that, one of the first questions I got was, well, what about fish? And is it okay to do this 5 days a week as opposed to 7 days a week? And what about margarine? These are all things that people hear every day. Fish is great. Margarine is better than butter. A little bit's better than none. Moderation is better than eating to excess. The 5 day a week question came from a man that wasn't tremendously overweight. He was actually pretty close to a normal ideal body weight. He also had had stents and a heart attack. But it's so hard for people to realize that what they do to themselves causes the problem. We're very good at, as humans, turning a blind eye to ourselves. It's also one of the things I like best about being a physician is being able to talk with people from all walks of life and try to get an idea of what makes them tick and what makes them think and what makes them turn the other way and how might I approach them best. As physicians, we need to be compensated for being successful like other people are compensated for being successful. And being successful as a physician means preventing disease and reversing disease that is already there, not for over-testing and doing all kinds of procedure, which oftentimes leads to more harm than good. Skin cancer is not going to kill someone in their 80s, and yet they come into my office all the time on multiple medication with holes and Band-Aids all over them, from where they've gotten biopsies for these precancerous lesions. And they've been made scared to death that if they don't have these little skin surgeries and don't have these procedures, that something bad is going to happen to them. The same thing also happens with colonoscopies. Colonoscopy was not meant to be the screening tool. The first line of action is a hemocult. The second line of action is perhaps a flexible SIG or even the camera pill. But it's certainly not going to kill an 80-year-old to not have a colonoscopy. And the contrary is often true, that colonoscopy can lead to perforation, can lead to all kinds of side effects in older individuals, the worst being progression or the acceleration of dementia. Because when we give these people anesthesia at this age for no good reason, sometimes they never get that memory back. But for some reason, when it comes to procedures, patients follow physicians' advice blindly. When it comes to dietary advice and change advice, rarely do they hear. But if you can subject yourself to a procedure, you can get people to do just about anything, and it's scary. We as physicians need to be able to get people to take a hard look at their own behaviors And that also means saying the obesity word, saying the significantly overweight word, saying that the obesity is leading to the disease and it's not normal. Obese patients are offered joint replacements and never educated on how they can lose weight to maybe even avoid having the joint replaced. Elderly people fall because they have no muscle mass and they're very obese and they lose their balance. These things are never addressed. You know, I've had several people that were significantly overweight on the podcast who've lost over 100 pounds, and they're amazing individuals. And I've learned a tremendous amount from them. And one thing I've learned is nobody wants to be significantly overweight. I think it can be emotionally crippling, especially if it lasts for years on end. I've also learned that there's not just one thing that leads people to, you know, kind of have the light bulb come on. It's not that easy. So, you know, when you see all these ads for, you know, to cure obesity on TV, whether it be with exercise programs, different diets, different procedures, in some respects, I think it's just taken care of. You know, they know that these people are searching for anything to help them. And I don't think that they're just looking for a quick answer. I think that by the time somebody becomes morbidly obese, they're really confused about what they possibly can do. As a physician, just to diagnose that someone's obese and recommend that they eat less and exercise more, they have a procedure, I think, is malpractice. Because I think you need to take time to assess what are the emotional aspects that may have led to them starting to overeat. When do they overeat? You know, what different people do different things. You know, are they mindless eating? Are they binge eating? Are they in a relationship where it's all about food? Do they live in a food desert and the only thing that they can get is cheap, quick, fast, high calorically dense food? At one time, did they not have the means and now they have all the money in the world and so they can eat what they want and use that as a way of expressing their success? I know growing up, my grandparents lived on a farm and they had six children. And if you could feed your family, that was a sign of success. And both my grandmothers tended to cook to show their love, or to feed us to show their love. And so whether it was making a special cake for your birthday or Easter eggs with your name on it or these big giant holiday meals, it was a way of expressing their love. And it's a way of reciprocating. We ate that food, not because we didn't want it, because we did want it. It was great. But it was that vicious cycle of we're going to eat all that we can and be stuffed and show our appreciation for them having made all this food. And it becomes this vicious cycle. And before you know it, people are tremendously overweight. And I actually came from a family that people were overweight. And that is what they did. You know, it wasn't one dessert. It was four desserts at one of these holiday get-togethers. And it was all just this high caloric dense food. But again, we all bragged on my grandmother showing just what a great cook they were and what great providers they were. But as physicians, we need to assess the situation and see if that's part of the role, because it's very difficult to correct that behavior if somebody's eating to please somebody else for having cooked for them, or somebody's cooking in order to show their love and that's the only means that they have. But you're certainly not going to tell those people, well, just go out and, you know, run 7 or 8 miles and then you can eat all that stuff you want. It doesn't work. The caloric density of foods has changed over the years. You know, back when, I guess I would say in the 60s and 70s, before there were processed foods, you may have received chicken that was fried and breaded in flour. But now chicken is pre-breaded and there is a bunch of sugar and salt and much more added, you know, many more additives to it. You know, things like tater tots or things that are breaded that people buy in the frozen food section have been pre-breaded, pre-fried, only to be fried again. And typically that occurs in most fast food restaurants. The stuff was already fried once, so they're double fried. There's double oil. So they're much more calorically dense and much more unhealthy for people. I agree with giving subsidies for food, but with that subsidy needs to come education, what is healthy and how best to feed your family. So I think we would be doing a much better service, and this probably comes down to the pediatrician, if we were educating parents on how to feed their children appropriately. And as family physicians and internists, how to feed your family appropriately and how to make choices. And if you're going to receive subsidies, probably should be seen, you probably should have counseling with a dietitian to help out. Otherwise, this vicious cycle of sickness continues. We give kids sugary things, processed things, and we're developing high blood pressure, diabetes in our poor population at a much earlier age than in the educated population. I believe it was Dr. Mills who talked about still continuing to feed or to confuse soul food with slave food, because in the days of slavery, we gave the slaves were given leftovers, you know, the poorest cuts of meat and high fat to work with. So they learned to make something out of nothing, and they made it their own, and it's now been passed down from culture to culture or generation to generation on this high fat, fried, cheap food. We need to educate that. You know, I often ask patients in my office, you know, especially patients from some of the islands, you know, what did you eat in Jamaica? What did you eat in Haiti? Were your family members overweight there? And they'll talk about fruits and vegetables and rice that they ate there. And it's like, but they're not eating that here. But they failed to make that connection. And they also feel as though they bettered themselves by being able to afford this purchased fast food. And, you know, I pat them on the back for the way they used to eat, not to the way that they're eating now. And that they need to go back, you know, it's like, well, you know what to eat. You just need to go back to what you're doing before. Or go back to the true roots of your eating. I also think that there's something to the addictive qualities of sugar, salt, and oil. It's certainly an easy thing to gravitate to, and our taste buds will gravitate to them. And you can certainly cover up just about any cheap food with salt, sugar, and oil and make it taste better. And we learn to love those tastes as opposed to the true taste of vegetables. So as physicians, we need to address the possible addictions and education on those. I don't necessarily think people are lazy or, and that's how things get out of hand. I think that perhaps it's the unawareness, and they really don't know what they're doing to themselves by eating this way. It's because it's seen as so normal. But I think that it does need to be pointed out that in some respects, in all respects, it's our responsibility as humans to be able to take care of ourselves and to take care of our children and to educate ourselves on what is healthy to eat. But we need to be able to turn to someone, and then that's where I think we turn to our physician educators. I think the field of gut microbes and is fascinating. If you think about that, we have 22,000 human genes and over 1 million microbial genes. The microbes are certainly running, you know, running us for the most part, and affects all aspects of our being. You know, the neurotransmitters are highly tied to emotions, which are, you know, led back to these neurotransmitters are facilitated by enzymes that are produced by our gut microbes. If we don't have healthy gut microbes, our colon isn't intact, and we get things called leaky gut and leads to multiple autoimmune disease, and autoimmune diseases being multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, lupus. All of these can be triggered back to or traced back to the gut microbe. Diabetes and hypercholesterolemia. Also, the fatty acids that are made by our good gut bacteria actually block the pathways to produce glucose and cholesterol. So what we eat affects what gut microbes that we stimulate to produce and to grow, good bacteria versus bad bacteria, and leads to disease. The reality is that a child's gut microbes largely, and the child's genetics comes largely from the mom and her 22,000 genes that contribute as well as her microbes. So that if we feed babies too early, they're not able to process food because they don't have the gut flora to be able to digest the food. It leads to leaky gut syndrome, and it probably has something to do with a lot of the allergies, perhaps autism, perhaps behavioral disorder, learning disorders. So we, again, as physicians, need to educate ourselves, but also educate the parents on how to feed their children. You know, I think it takes a village. My daughter got married. We talked about it takes a village to raise a child, and it did in my house. And, you know, she was fortunate to be surrounded by, a wealth of friends and family and grandparents to help her along her path and to show her right from wrong. I think it takes a village for people to know how to feed their children. We can't rely on fast food because we're so busy to just go through a drive-through or start feeding a child cereal instead of breast milk because it's quick and convenient. It certainly helps if the whole family is involved in the raising of a child, but it also helps if there's a physician there to help direct them and to take an interest in what the child's eating and to take an interest in the environment of the child. We can't let our children get to the point of being obese. The emotional stigma, the health, they're starting to get coronary artery disease, high blood pressure, diabetes at a younger and younger age. It's not just a phase. And we have to be educated as parents in order to say no to some of these things that we know aren't good for our children. Everyone realizes that sugary soft drinks are not good for their children. Yet, you know, we tend to bow down and you know, think that treat that as a reward. Treats have always been a reward for kids, but never in the massive quantities that they are now. Children can't hardly hold the cups that they get with these sugary soft drinks. I can remember when I was little, I played Little League. I went from tap dancing class to Little League. And if we won, our coach, who was also our dentist, would take us over to the stand and get us a Coca-Cola. And it was in those tiny little cups, not much bigger than a Dixie cup, what we call now. But we had a Coke, and that was it. If we lost, we didn't get a Coke. But if we won, we got a Coke. And so there was probably two sips of Coke. You know, it was ice in the little cup with, you know, a little Coke. But again, nowadays, it's these giant drinks that we, for some reason, we have to supersaturate everything. Most people won't respond to being told that they're fat and lazy and it's all their fault. And so as physicians, we need to figure out a way to communicate with people and to help them. And I know on days that I've kind of lost my cool and I've never really said you're fat and lazy and you need to get a hold of yourself. But, you know, I've got over passionate, so to speak, as far as you need to change, you know, you're killing yourself. And I don't feel near as good about myself after I leave the room as if I've encouraged someone and we've kind of found something that's positive along the way. So, you know, again, physicians need to take responsibility for how best to educate each patient and how to figure out how to motivate them the best that they can. But it takes time and it can't happen in a 10-minute window. And there's no test or questionnaire that's going to fix that problem. Last week on the way to the airport at 5 o'clock in the morning, we went by a gym, and it had all windows, and it was predominantly filled with overweight women just stepping and jumping, and they were trying their best, you know, to lose weight and get the weight off and fix things as quickly as possible. And when you look at it, you know, it seems crazy. It's just nothing more than a hamster wheel, because you know these people are going to exercise like crazy for an hour and a half, and then they're going to go and have a protein shake and think that they're doing okay, and it's going to be a vicious cycle, and they're not going to be able to lose the weight. What a great alternative would be maybe to sleep an extra hour and then get their children up and actually walk them to the bus stop instead of drive them to the bus stop. Maybe actually go outside and play with the children after school, as opposed to these prearranged activities or team sports that all kids are doing now. I can remember when I was growing up, after dinner, my mom would come out and we would, all the neighborhood kids would be outside and we'd play softball. And there was always a parent or two that would be participating. And what about gardening? You know, what about involving the children into gardening and gardening? I know we sweat off pounds of water here in Florida trying to garden, in the heat. But it's an enjoyable and it's relaxing and you're focused and, it's somewhat meditative. But if the family, was involved in gardening, look at the exercise that they would get. They would be together. They would learn where their food comes from. You know, the other option is when kids are at practice walking and exercising then, as opposed to, these cramped up gyms where it's dark and there's all these germs inside. The other alternatives is to coach and participate in the kids' sports. I know when my daughter was small, I always wanted to be an Olympic swimmer, so I put her in swim class. So I started swimming when she was swimming, and then she didn't really want to do that, and she didn't see the Olympic potential. So, I put her in another sport, and that's when I started running while she was in another, in another sport until she found her niche. And then I ended up actually coaching some of the sports that she played in. But it's a great way to spend time with your kids. Or your grandkids, and you're getting exercise, and you're moving all around. I think sometimes when we just do these repetitious sports, it's boring, and so people can't stick it out. So why should we as physicians not take a diet, take an exercise history on patients and find out what it is they're doing and what it is that they like to do and help them to find a sport that they could participate in or an activity that they could participate in with their families that would help them? We need to point out that it's not okay not to be able to touch your toes at 40 years of age. That you should be able to get down on the floor and play with your grandkids and get back up without having to grab onto something. We need to educate people that they don't need a sugary drink or some sort of sports drink to do 30 minutes of exercise. If your physician is not asking those questions and talking to you about those things, they are not doing their job. I have eliminated drug reps from coming into my office. I don't accept samples, I don't accept lunch, I don't accept pens. If there's a medication that's been out long enough that I need to use it or consider using it in people that I can't treat with nutrition, then I'm going to read the studies on my own. If your physician wants to do a stress test on you just because you're 40 years of age or just because that's not a reason, there should be a pre-test probability that something may be going on before you do a test. And you need to know what would happen if that test was positive or negative and what they plan on doing with it and what constitutes a positive or negative test. If you've actually done a stress test and they've turned it off before you were ready to, or that you were so tired of walking that you needed to stop, then that was not an adequate test. If the physician wasn't in the room for that stress test while you were walking on the treadmill, then you didn't have an adequate test because they weren't there to assess what you look like, what you were breathing, and your functional capacity. Looking at bone density is a questionable procedure in and of itself, but looking at bone density without being educated on diet and exercise is not adequate. No amount of calcium pills will reverse osteoporosis, but decreasing your animal protein will, and exercising and doing body weight training. Ask your physician if they want to do a test that involves radiation, how many chest x-rays. Typically, a CAT scan is about 200 chest x-rays. So do you really want 200 chest x-rays just to see if there might be something there when you could actually change your diet and prevent something from being there? So it really all comes back to nutrition, because learning to eat properly will reverse and prevent most diseases. How it does it, we're not exactly sure on some of these. You know, eating beans will lower your heart rate. We don't know why. Eating a high fiber diet, we're starting to learn, you know, feeds our good gut microbes and feeds back and decreases our glucose and cholesterol production. So there's many things, as Dr. Campbell would say, that all work together in a symphony to help us. But one thing I can tell you for sure is eating fast foods and eating box foods and prepackaged foods into excess and not doing exercise is not going to lead to health and happiness. So should we doctor bash, or should we ask our doctors to take responsibility, or should we ask ourselves to take responsibility? I think we should hold each other accountable. Demand adequate time with your physician in order to get your questions answered. And don't be afraid to ask any question of your physician. And if they can't answer it, then you need to get a new physician. And if your physician doesn't look healthy, then you need to get a new physician. Your doctor really does want you to be healthy. Sometimes they just need to be awakened as to how they're going to accomplish that. I enjoy teaching my nutrition class, and I would be very reluctant to give it up to someone else to teach it, just because I like the interaction with my patients, and I like to see them be successful. And I don't trust their education on their health to anyone else at this point. On a lighter note, Hurricane Herme, or whatever her name is, has passed through Florida. It's some rain down here, but my okra are still standing and my baby mango trees are still standing. I've got jicama starting to grow. I've got little peppers in and tomatoes. Sweet potatoes are still there, and we're getting ready to plant our fall gardens down here in Florida. If you live up north, consider microgreens inside, maybe a tower garden inside, or at least herbs in the windowsill. Try to get to your local farmer's market. My goal is to be able to raise a significant amount of my vegetables in my backyard in the fall and spring, and have a significant amount of fruit for the summer, and a few summer vegetable crops. So that would be that's my goal for my backyard. As for my exercise program, I am starting to concentrate more on flexibility and strength through flexibility, as well as training for my Ironman that's getting closer, second week in October in Louisville. So swim, bike, run is all important. So I'm doing multiple swim, bikes, and runs every week, and increasing the duration. Not all of my swim, bikes, and runs are good, but you know, I try to find something positive about each one of them, whether it's just the ability to endure the distance or the time, or to concentrate on a stroke or a technique, or to learn something about nutrition, what nutrition works and what doesn't. We experimented with a different sports drink this week, and it just didn't work at all. We absorbed it way too quick, and I felt really tired. I could have taken a nap on the bike, so I certainly don't want any part of that in the Ironman race. I've been really enjoying rehydrating with watermelon after we do long bike rides, and fruit smoothies after my morning runs. I think that it's really a great way to get hydrated and to get some nutrients. I've also started juicing some carrots after being at the Stanford Inn. So I've been enjoying some carrot juice as dessert. It's very sweet and satisfying, and it takes long enough to make, as far as when you make it and then you have to clean up the juicer, so that I sit down and actually enjoy it. So something I don't feel too guilty about. I post a lot of my dinner meals and some of my lunches on Instagram. So if you want to follow me on Instagram, that would be great, at Jamila Delaney. I'm on Facebook the same way. You can email me at jamiedelaney@gmail.com. It's spelled jamiedelaney@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter as well, but not that often. Please check out my website at drdelaney.com. I'm still working on the full day conference in the wintertime. We're trying to lock down a venue so that we get our speaker set, and I'll keep that posted on the website. The nutrition classes I'm running 6 weeks in a row, and then I'm going to recycle right into another session. So if you live in this area and would like to do a nutrition class, we'd love to have you. You certainly don't have to be my patient. And if you want some sort of consultation and you live far away, as far as your medications or how to get off them according to your diet, we can figure that out too now with some telemedicine conferences. So keep in touch, and I hope that you continue to email me with questions and keep me accountable, and I'll take responsibility for trying to help you the best that I can. So take care, and I'll see you next week.